Okay, so here's maybe the core of it. Let me push you like this. I think you define a freedom of press and you put it in the democracy category. But isn't that like the core liberal category? That it's the core liberal guarantee of pluralism. That's a liberal guarantee, not a democratic guarantee necessarily, because it shapes, it allows one to shape and participate in the shaping of a society. And so you've criticized Orban, for example, for really cracking down on things like that, because it precludes what would be a fair democratic process from taking place. But that's a liberal
thing. Yeah, so it's not about liberalism.
Well, I mean, it's a move that you make to say, well, this is not liberalism, this is democracy. But I wonder if that's true. Because again, getting back to the question of, you know, the worry about wokeism is that it's, you know, it's, I don't know, again, I'm not sure how much I buy it, but you know, the argument is that it's shaping people's ability on how to even speak publicly. That by the, you know, control of the institutions, people are inhibited and their manners of thought are changing. And in fact,
that's fine.
Even those manners of thought are undermining the adherence to a basic liberal democratic, but I'd even say liberal value of granting everyone the ability to speak freely in the public sphere. Again, whether that's democratic liberal, I'll let you deal with that. But
So
you know, you want, I would throw to you then that even for sort of Islamists in other countries who you are granting a, you know, legitimacy due to democracy, there's a minimal liberalism embedded in your conception of the kind of minimal democracy you want in these societies, right? Is that fair?
Yeah, you have to have some individual freedoms for democracy to work, but not because those individual rights are transcendent or almost like metaphysically awesome. It's because democracy is about the right to oppose. And if you limit certain freedoms, then opposition parties won't have a legitimate shot at winning the next election. So it's about protecting the ability for people to make decisions on a collective level. So you can ban parties. And if you prevent any opposition media from operating, then how do opposition parties communicate their views to voters? So that's sort of how I come out on it. And I don't think these things are interchangeable because, you know, prohibition is illiberal. You're restricting individual freedom. So if we think about liberalism as the expansion of individual freedom and choice, then clearly if Islamist parties come to power, they will be restricting that in some way. If national conservatives in America come to power, they'll be restricting certain freedoms when it perhaps comes to gay rights or trans rights and so forth. So the liberalism spectrum is still relevant for judging. It's a continuum. It's not a binary. It's not one or the other. But we kind of go back and forth along this spectrum, and then we can kind of assess, is something more or less liberal than it previously was, right?
Yeah. I guess the interesting thing is you know, on the one hand, the way you phrased it, and I think this applies to Orbanism, but it's a squirrely thing, and this is why I think the right in this country has latched onto Orban in a lot of ways. You're saying he's, you know, preventing parties from organizing, getting their message out, limiting their access to certain media and the rest of this. And that's true. But, you know, I think the more difficult thing is, you know, imagine that he allowed, there was some law in the books that allowed equal advertising on whatever, I don't even know if the Hungarians have a state channel. I presume they do, like all European countries. You know, allowed for some kind of like equal time clause ahead of elections. But still, he had managed through his, you know, crony capitalism, corrupt dealings to consolidate most of the media in the country around his vision. So you still have blogs, which I think you still do in Hungary. You know, you have like sort of small things, but they're not able to punch through the actual kind of hegemony over the media. And I think that's the the parallel to both wokeism and I think the counter fantasy by the national conservatives is like, well, if we only are allowed to do that, we'll even grant you your minimal conception, but we'll shape people's conceptions and narratives so much by controlling the main things. And we will insist on you know, putting these kinds of ideas that we think are the common good into it and just frame the entire debate around that. That's where I think a lot of liberals are up in arms. And I guess that's what I'm pressing you on specifically is what's the line for you domestically in the United States? Never mind Hungary, never mind, you know, Egypt or any other states in the Middle East that are going through a lot of this stuff. In the United States,
My line is coercion. This is why I don't buy the argument that wokeness, the hegemony of wokeness is like authoritarianism. Because, you know, for the most part, I would say with few exceptions, it's not the state itself that is forcing people to be quiet or restricting their speech. We're talking more about corporations or newspapers or publications, which are independent and or private. So, you know, corporations have the right to determine their own policies as they see fit. I don't like it. So Twitter and Facebook, we may disagree with their decisions, but ultimately those are their decisions to make. And if the New York Times wants to promote wokeness and doesn't give voice to sufficient conservative voices, that's also an institutional prerogative. So I just don't buy this argument that we're living in anything close to authoritarianism. And this is an argument that does annoy me when I hear it from the illiberal right here in the US. And it's something I hear more and more often, and I can sympathize with where they're coming from, but I can also point out that they haven't, most of them, lived under an actual dictatorship. And trust me, it is very, very different. It is not the same. So where I would start to get very concerned is when there are actually speech codes or things or outlets are being closed through state power and coercion. That's what we would have to watch out for. I think it's very unlikely for obvious reasons, but that's what makes me a little bit more optimistic that we still have a vibrant public debate, because it's very difficult to imagine the state getting involved in speech, even in the way that some European countries are still largely liberal democratic, but they have, for example, speech codes that would never fly here because of the First Amendment. That would worry me. So even if we inch a little bit towards the Western European model of criminalizing certain kinds of bigotry that aren't clearly defined, that's the sort of thing that would maybe spiral out of control. But short of that, you know what? If the woke are able to get their message out and capture institutions, that means they've done something effectively. It's our fault for not effectively opposing them. But you have the right to promote your own hegemony in a democratic setting, right?
Yeah. I mean, I don't have very developed opinions on that. I agree with largely everything you said there. I'm just struck, you know, the person who I think, and he's not alone, but I think a lot of the kind of people who, you know, even have memories of the Cold War and have like read a lot about how the Cold War authoritarian societies worked in the European context under communism. I think the thing that spooks them about wokeness is the ideological component of it and the kind of ideological coercion. You're right, the state doesn't have a role and doesn't seem like it's going to at any one point soon. But there is a concern, and maybe it's misplaced, that, you know, letting an ideology, if we are to give ideology agency like this, but letting an ideology rule over a set of institutions has implications for, you know, certain rights and freedoms down the road. But maybe not. I mean, I don't know. I've always felt like that's an overstated case, but I've never really engaged with it enough to come out one way or the other on it, you know?
Look, I see where it comes from, and people don't say what they actually think. We know this from all the available polling that that's getting worse. People are self-censoring. But you know what? They don't have to self-censor. And again, maybe this is me coming from a place of privilege that I'm sufficiently secure, you know, professionally and financially, where I can take risks. And if there's blowback, I can get through it and survive without it being absolutely devastating. Granted, many people don't have that luxury, but that's still different because they can go to a different university or a different institution if they're an academic, or an institution that is more explicitly supportive of free speech. It might not be easy, and if you're on a tenure track in a particular university, to kind of start from scratch somewhere else and all that. I mean, all of this is quite challenging, but I don't know what you can really do about that besides fight back internally over time and try to persuade your fellow employees or faculty members that there should be a different way of doing things. That requires ideological persuasion. I think it's unfortunate that the free speech side has been losing in these debates, because I think our position is the more obvious one, intuitive one, and it's not ridiculous. But clearly not being ridiculous is not enough to persuade people. But that's probably, like, we're partly at fault. We must have done something wrong. Like, if we weren't able to bring enough people along with our vision for being more protective of free speech and open inquiry, I mean, we must be partly to blame. Like, we haven't been conveying our views in a sufficiently compelling way. We are not consistent or principled enough, or people want more meaning, so we can't just give them free speech. We have to give them a vision that is more inspiring and affirmative, and we failed to do that, and we've just fallen back on liberal neutrality, and people aren't content. As we've talked about this, a lot of this comes down to the fact that people are not happy with the status quo, and they don't have religion. At least a lot of them don't have religion, so they look for alternative ideologies. Wokeness is one of them. So liberalism, because it has a thinness to it, because it doesn't offer sufficient meaning, at least as it's currently conceived, and it's chaotic and people have too much choice, that the resulting unhappiness fuels this search for alternative ideologies. So that's where I think we failed, in that we haven't given people enough to believe in.
Nothing to contest there. I guess I'm just struck by another sort of shift that just happened and how you're describing it. No, but hear me out, because I guess I'm just trying to push you into sort of defining your relationship to liberalism. And I mean, we've been doing this long enough. I have a pretty good sense of it. But the shift there was one of initially describing liberalism as somehow, you know, so deeply embedded in our culture that you're not worried about it being properly undermined by, you know, either wokeism or, you know, a resurgent religious nationalism that somehow, you know, by control of institutions, et cetera, as long as certain minimum free speech things are left alone, you're fine with it. But then now you've just described liberalism as an ideology that is, you know, under threat by these self-same forces and is unable to provide the kind of meaning. And again, none of that's surprising to me. Just the juxtaposition between the embeddedness of it in a society and your comfort with that embeddedness, then tempered with this idea that it's just another competing ideology, and, you know, we need to do better to defend our side, our ideological side, and maybe ground it a little better so that the other ones fall off. I don't know. There might not be a contradiction.
There's a tension there.
But it's interesting.
There's definitely a tension there. I'd probably have to think about it a little bit more about how to resolve that tension. Yeah. But you know what? I think I'm also comfortable saying that not all tensions have to be resolved, because I struggle with these issues. Because I'm a liberal who's critical of liberalism, sometimes I feel like I want to fight for quote-unquote liberalism. And again, like, what do we really mean when we say that? Here I was talking more specifically about, you know, free speech on universities. There's other parts of the liberal idea that I'm maybe less enthusiastic about. But sometimes there's things that I think are worth fighting for that are generally considered to fall under liberalism. And then there are things that I'm more critical of, the unlimited choice and the focus on individual autonomy at the expense of collective sense of the good. And God forbid, I just used a version of the common good, which I just wrote a piece kind of against. But it's more complicated than that. And that's why I'm trying to work out those tensions in my Wisdom of Crowds pieces, because I do go a little bit back and forth on this. And that's going to be an ongoing tension. And I know people aren't comfortable with too much internal tension, but I guess I'm getting a little bit more comfortable with it. And I'm fine with sharing my thought process with people out loud, or at least on the page.
Yeah. All right. I just think for me, the interesting thing on this is less about you and in the domestic context, because I think we've known each other for a long time, and this podcast is, you know, I think we know each other even better as a result of it, from talking to each other all the time in this mode. So I don't think I'd be particularly surprised by anything you would do in any of these sort of putative scenarios going forward within the United States. I'm a little more interested in how this relates to international relations, maybe. And what I was pushing you earlier on, this idea of whether there is an embedded liberalism in what you want for other societies. And in your sort of minimalist democratic thing. And, you know, maybe then grappling with, you know, how that relates to foreign policy a little bit. I mean, these are huge topics, so it's not going to get resolved in a short little bonus segment here. But I do wonder, because, you know, I feel like I'm in my own head for myself kind of, I don't have a lot of these tensions because I don't impute an inherent value to any of these systems necessarily. As I said, I like living in a liberal society, but it's just a mode of organization. It's fragile. It could or couldn't go. I can imagine many different ways it could collapse. But when thinking about guiding foreign policy based on these principles, grounded as they are for me on like contingencies that run at the limit of the state, I don't find myself compelled to argue for a broader program for the world. And that's why I keep pushing you to sort of make a religious program for foreign policy, quite frankly, grounded in certain religious concepts, not in sort of this like loose rights talk. But then, of course, I think that's alienating to a lot of people because it sounds like crusades or some bullshit like that. So I don't know. I run with that if you have some thoughts.
Well, you know, but look, there's a practical argument for it, that the more autocracies there are in the world and the stronger they become, the more it threatens the U.S. So you don't necessarily have to rely on religious or moral premises to come to a similar conclusion. If there is in fact a struggle between democracies and autocracies, a simplification, but still, I think it gets at something real that's going on now. Then if we want to protect, and I don't mean to sound like some American politician on an ad, but if we want to protect the American way of life, then we do have to oppose authoritarian regimes abroad. So that would be the simpler practical argument that's accessible to a larger number of Americans, even if they have no interest in morality.
Yeah.
But I would say morality is part of who we are. So that sense of moral mission is embedded in the American idea. So if we want to continue being America, we can't completely discard those things because then we'd be something other than what we are. So it's almost like, maybe that's a little bit circular, and feel free to push back on that. But I would also say that we derive strength from our morality, that part of the reason that America is able to project its power throughout the world in a way that China still hasn't been able to and probably won't be able to, is because we are a democracy and because we are better at some fundamental level, as I, you know, as I've argued since the Ukraine conflict started, we are better than Russia. We are better than China, and we're better and morally superior because we are democratic. And that resonates with more people throughout the world. I mean, it's not as if people are clamoring for the Russian model or they want to implement the Chinese model. Some people occasionally say that, but is there a big shift towards Chinese cultural norms and being like China? Not really, not really. So that's what I would say. That would be the broader argument for Americans, that there is a long struggle. We are better. So on and so forth.
Yeah. I mean, I push back. I guess I just push back. I wonder, you know, part of our worry about China is that they are becoming economically powerful. And that with that, all sorts of, call it moral suasions come along with that. I think that's at the core of why what we're worried about with China, that that in fact, it's, we know that at the core, it's less our values and way of life that's attractive and more the fact that we're successful and powerful. And yeah, we're quote unquote better than Russia, largely because our military doesn't just implode when it goes into conflict. We're more competent and much richer.
But
so there's,
but
that.
Also, like, whatever you want to say about the American military, and this is a point that I made to Glenn, and I wish reiterate it, like, we don't, American military leaders and officers don't go into battle thinking, let us kill civilians. I'm comfortable saying that the way that our military is structured, that's never an express intent on any kind of systematic level, that we are going in to kill as many people as possible to force them to capitulate and surrender. So like, there's also that.
Hiroshima, Nagasaki.
I was recently talking more about like presently, like in the present tense.
But I
if
mean,
we're comparing ourselves to
be
Russia.
To be fair, we've not been in an existential struggle like World War II. We did contemplate using nuclear weapons in the Korean War when we were worried about it.
But we don't derive pleasure. Like, I don't think it's fair to say that America.
What do you think? Putin's masturbating right now to like civilians dying?
I think there is a level of comfort with mass killing. Like, there is no moral conflict or struggle. And we've gotten the intercepts from, you know, Russian officers saying basically like, go, you know, if you want to rape people, go forth. I mean, that sort of thing. They're just like a wanton like immorality that I just don't think is present in the American armed forces.
Yeah, I don't like the whataboutism. I just don't think you should make very sweeping claims about our respect for civilian life. And you can then limit it and say, well, since we've been fighting, you know, low intensity colonial wars, we haven't engaged in such wanton slaughter. Yeah, sure. But you
I mean,
know,
to be fair, like, is the Russian invasion of
is it existential for them? Yeah, they think it is. That's
no, but
why
it's
they
not,
did it.
Though.
No,
it is
I
a
mean,
low.
It's existential to their conception of the Russian Empire and who they think they are. No, for sure it is. No. I mean, you may think it's silly. Hmm. You may think it's silly, but they certainly see it that way. I'm not saying they're right to see it that way, but I can fully appreciate how they see this. They see this as
okay, but an offensive war of choice is not an existential battle like World War II,
they think they're fighting NATO. Like, again, you can say that they're stupid and misguided, but at least you should take them at their word. You know what I mean?
Look, I don't doubt that they believe, or some of them believe, that this is real. I think it's just inaccurate and wrong.
Sure,
like,
that's fine.
I don't have to defer to their conception of what's real.
Like I said, I don't like doing this, what Glenn got us doing, this like whataboutism, like what about what we did in Iraq and stuff like that. I think it's not that I don't take your argument, this argument that no, we're good and our intentions were better and therefore we're better. I don't really take much truck with that. I just say, yeah, we kill people too. That's fine. War is an ugly thing. And because it's largely true. I think if we were in a war that, that truly mattered to us, we would kill a lot of people and we would use a terror weapon to like break another country if it was really threatening our very existence. Absolutely.
Would we be able to get rid of rules of engagement? I mean, just institutionally, I'm not sure what
the president
that
would order
like.
It. Truman signed the orders, right?
Okay. Yeah. So you're, fair enough. You're taking, though, a very extreme example and an unusual one in American history. We can't necessarily generalize from that.
How is it unusual in American history? Civil War, what the North did, like what Sherman did, that was it's the nature of war. What I don't like is this idea that, you know, war needs to be, we need to talk about a civilized way of doing war. War involves inflicting pain on the enemy. And the extent to which we don't do it in some of our wars is because these wars don't matter. So we are able to actually be pious about it. But the fact is, war crimes exist, but they exist, again, this gets back to the whole question of authority and moral authority. It exists either before something we like to think is God, and so that we will burn in everlasting hell for doing these sorts of things. Or then there's this concept of, you know, international justice, which really is just undergirded by American hegemony or Western hegemony. At some point that breaks down and it doesn't matter. So, you know, again, you can say that these are crimes before God and we're all going to suffer. You made a case for that, but for Putin and the rest of this, I don't have recourse to that. I just don't buy it. So I just sort of shrug a little bit about this kind of hand-wringing about violence. I think Russia should be stopped. And once we win, there should be victor's justice and we should try them and hang them. But, you know, it's not grounded in any like transcendent concept of justice.
Okay, but what I would say that it's much more, the deeper difference here is that because we are citizens of a democracy and because our sort of moral intuition has not been distorted to the extent that it would be in an authoritarian regime, this gets back to, I think, a fundamental difference according to regime type, that our moral intuitions are stronger because we live under a democracy. And therefore, if we were in a situation where we were like bombing schools and like massacring large numbers of people, I think that enough Americans, maybe not a majority, who knows, it's not for me to say, but because we're a democracy, enough Americans would express revulsion and communicate that to their representatives. Would that be enough to change the policy? I don't know. Depends how existential the battle was perceived to be by Americans. But at least that avenue would be open because our souls haven't been twisted the way that the Russian soul perhaps has been twisted under the better part of nearly a century of dictatorship with only minor interruption. So that does matter, I think. And it does help explain why so many Russians seem to have taken morally indefensible positions over the course of this war.
I guess I disagree on that. I mean, it's at the core of my argument about the no-fly zone, which you found not persuasive that democracies actually can't constrain themselves. And I mean, there's been some political science work on this. I have a book somewhere. It's been since grad school, since I read it. But, you know, just sort of marveling at the fact that at how ruthless democracies are, in fact, in pursuing wars that they find, absolutely important and necessary to win, and how they're able to actually lather themselves up into a kind of fury and frenzy and have a society-wide commitment that authoritarian regimes actually don't have access to. And that, in fact, there's nothing less bloody about wars persecuted by democracies than by authoritarian regimes. So I don't know. I'd question that. And my priors push me into a different direction. This idea that we are more morally subtle as a people because we're, you know, have the gift of democracy. I don't know. That doesn't
It's definitely
right
not
to me.
Demir speak. It's definitely something that you would not take to naturally. So I totally get that. Yeah. It is kind of like the opposite of Demir.
Yeah.
Almost like the platonic ideal of the opposite of Demir.
So you're trolling me then. Fair enough.
No, I believe. No.
All right, Shadi.
That meant
Maybe
yeah,
on that
this was
note,
fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
Talk to you later.
Bye, Demir.
Bye.